Hey, what's up? You're listening to the Chatta Heavy Podcast with Casey
and Jason. We're going to talk about the rise of the heavy music scene in Southeast Tennessee. So you were booking shows for your band within the play, I'm sure, trying to gain more notoriety, trying to cultivate this community that you've kind of laid the groundwork for. What made you want to stop booking shows at other venues and rather take on a brand new set of responsibilities and having your own building to run shows out of?
In 2007, I remember just being mildly frustrated with, you know, some of the different policies at other venues around Chattanooga or some of the different ways that things are being done. And since I was like a promoter slash booking guy, you know, I was working with these other places. And I just remember telling a good friend of mine at the time who was working with me, hey, like, what would it look like for us to open our own place and kind of like set our own rules, you know, do our own thing, book our own shows at our specific, you know, venue. And we started entertaining the idea and started looking at buildings and looking at places. And I don't know, that just kind of sparked once again the kind of entrepreneur business side of me that said, okay, I think we could do this. I think we could pull it off. And it'd be amazing to have our own place. I'd been booking shows at that point for 5 or 6 years, you know, under other roofs. And finally, you know, an opportunity kind of came up to where we could have our own place. And so,
but that's a major commitment, right? So we're in 2007, but right before this,
right?
I feel like Within was, at its peak. Like, what was going on there? I figured you were also still trying to take your band, your baby, your vision for music so far, your creative outlet, and trying to make it as big as possible. What made you kind of step in a different direction that was really going to root you here in Chattanooga and not really enable you to tour anymore?
Yeah, I didn't really think about it like that. I thought that at the time, in my head, I just said, well, the venue is only going to help promote the band. I was like, they work one and the same.
Right.
And similar to that, what actually started, what a lot of people didn't remember or don't necessarily didn't know about, we actually had a livestock festival first in 07, before the warehouse ever opened. We had our first outdoor music festival out in Harrison area of outside Chattanooga. And it went well, and we had some great bands, and My Children, My Bride played it, With Faith or Flames played it, Within played it.
So this wasn't on the Goodner family farm?
It was.
Or yes, it was? Okay.
It was. It was just a different location on the farm. But so, and that was in 07. That was right before that kind of launched us into starting our own venue. So that first festival went well, and we kind of out of that, we didn't make any money, but out of that we said, okay, now we're ready to open a venue.
It's like you built your confidence. Like,
right, yeah. It was just kind of a, I don't know. It wasn't like a dry run of booking because I'd been doing that for years. It was like we had the team, I guess. There was a group of us at the time, a friend group of maybe 10 of us that just said, okay, this is, now we're ready. And we have like a staff. We were all volunteers, but we had this crew, the staff, and then we said, okay, let's do this. And
who are some of the main people helping you out at that time?
Yeah, for sure. Andy Goodner was there throughout all that. A good friend of mine named Matt Holland and his wife, Shelley. And at the time, my girlfriend at the time, Autumn, and her sister, Aubrey. And then they had close friends in their circle, Clayton and Zach, and a few others there, and both of my brothers helped along the way as well, and then a couple of older friends, my buddy Nick, and my buddy David, that ended up being in this hour, was part of it.
So and early on, you felt like, after running this first livestock, you had this solid crew of people that you you had all this confidence in at this point now.
Right.
Because up to this point, you had booked shows by yourself under Scenic City Booking, probably mostly door splits and stuff to pay bands. And now you've ran your own outdoor festival where you had to rent your own sound, rent tents maybe at the time, set up a stage, figure out how to take money, maybe get wristbands, keep people from doing illegal things, right? Mm-hmm. But you had this whole crew of people that you had faith in to help you do all that. So do you think that's what really helped you with that next step forward, pushed you forward into now you and Matt Holland going and partnering and finding a space to do this full time?
Yeah, I think so for sure. I think, you know, you're only as good as the team around you, kind of that old saying, I guess. So I for sure feel that way. You know, without those other 10 that were around me, it wouldn't have happened the way that it did. So next thing, me and Matt found a building. It fell through. It didn't work out. We found a second building, and then it almost didn't work out.
Talk to me about Matt. Matt was your original partner. When people see the warehouse, when it very first started, you were kind of still the face, and Matt was more of the business and handyman, really helped make a lot of the physical things happen.
Sure. I think because I was in a band at the time that was the front man of the band, I guess I was, you know, a little bit more well-known around the music scene in Chattanooga than Matt was. But Matt was in a band as well years before that.
What band was that?
So he was in a band called Six Step Program. They were kind of like a rock, alternative rock group. And
did they play those Fathom shows with you guys?
They did, yeah. So we played with them a few times at Fathom, and we definitely weren't great friends with them by any stretch. And Matt has a whole other story about that. But over time, though, you know, kind of we all, you know, settled on differences and things like that, and it was fine. There was just mild drama around it at one given point. But
so how did you go from mild drama to partnering with someone in a financial risk?
Yeah, I think in early 07, it would have been January of 07, me and Matt became closer friends because we were going to the same church together.
Okay.
So gotcha. Out of that, and same with Andy, whose farm that we had the livestock festival at. So me and Andy and Matt were all three pretty close friends around the beginning of 07. So then we had the music festival, let's say that summer. By that fall, and me and Matt were working a job together as well. So we were with each other almost every day.
Yeah, a lot of time together.
And okay. So we started looking for buildings as a team, and we finally landed on a building there in East Ridge in the strip mall. And kind of a crazy story about that. Space in East Ridge, we were told pretty early on that the building wasn't coded, or it wasn't up to code for what they would call assembly occupancy. So you couldn't have like a large group of people there at that specific building. So
was this by the county or the state?
This is by like East Ridge City.
East Ridge City,
right.
Okay.
Right. So this, East Ridge is its own little city. It has like a town hall and a, you know, I don't know if there's a mayor or not. I think
its
maybe.
Like, well, maybe it's, there so it's is, got yeah. ordinances
right,
as
sure.
far as these sort of things go.
So, yeah. So we were told pretty early on, hey, that particular building that you guys have already leased, which was fun, you can't do what you're wanting to do in that building. Okay. So what we did was we said, okay, is there any way around it? And we met with a few of the officials. We met with the fire marshal, talked with him a while. And so they said, they listened to our story. Here's what we're trying to do. You know, we told them exactly what it was going to be. Hey, this is going to be an all-ages music venue. And they're like, what is that? We don't even know what that is, really. So we explained to them a little bit more of the idea of what would be going on, exactly what it would look like. I mean, they wanted details of exactly what we were going to be doing at this place. So it took about, we were ready to open, and we actually had our first first event booked, our grand opening, for sometime in January of 2008. And we ended up having to push it back to late March. I don't remember the exact date, but late March 2008 ended up being the first official show. And I remember that first official show, the police chief of East Ridge was there. The fire marshal was there as well. And it wasn't because they were upset. They were just wanting to really come see for their with their own eyes. They're like, hey, what's going on here? What is this really? And so...
So actually they were big fans.
No, I don't think they were fans, but they ended up appreciating it, and they, you know, they had good things to say of like, hey, this is awesome. I think the young people of East Ridge do need somewhere to go, or whatever they said.
Well, talk to me about that first show. Like, who played? What kind of numbers did you have? What kind of impression do you think that made on Chief of Police and Fire Marshal?
Yeah, the first show was Within played, the band show, The Fight played, the band, the Radio Fix actually played their last show ever that night. Later they did a reunion show, but that was their official last show, that the first day of us opening there. And a buddy of mine named Jordan Hawkwist played that show, which Matt, co-owner of the warehouse, was in Jordan's band. So and then I'm wanting to say also In This Hour played that show, I think, if I remember correctly as well. So, and then David and Andrew from In This Hour and Nick, they were all great friends of mine. So, and they had a lot to do with helping, you know, remodel the space and kind of get it ready and get it going.
So it seems like a lot of your initial volunteer staff were also in the bands that performed at the warehouse.
Right. Yeah, they were, for sure.
Cool.
And then a couple of the other guys that were helping out eventually formed the band Behold the Brave. And they helped us, you know, early on those first year to 2 years.
So how are the numbers that night? What kind of impression do you think it made on these like official?
If I remember right, we did maybe 150 that night. It was a really good show.
From my memory serves me correct, is technically 180 cap room, right?
Right. Yeah, it was. Yeah, I mean,
so that's great.
It was a little under 200 was the official cap, and so obviously that night we couldn't break it because the fire marshal's in the room. You know, he's watching the bands play. So I mean, it was you know, cool on one hand that they were there and that they supported us, and the police chief of East Ridge was there. And that provided, you know, another level of security, which was cool. But at the same time, you know, there was a lot of stress and pressure of, okay, we've got to get this right tonight. They're here and they're watching and they're, you know, that whole thing too. So,
well, do you think having a full room like that, and maybe not the best sound you've ever probably ever put on, but probably decent, right? Since it was early on.
Maybe.
Do you think that made a pretty good impression? Do you think it gave these officials in the city of East Ridge like faith in what you guys were trying to explain to them, what you wanted to do? Like that maybe like you guys weren't just a couple of kids screwing around, that you actually were going to try to make a difference?
I think so. Yeah, I think it did. And that they saw that we were, even though we were young and we didn't have a lot of money behind us, that you could tell that pretty quickly. You know, I think I was 23. I'm wanting to say Matt was 21 whenever we first started. So yeah, I mean, we were young and we didn't have a lot of backing at all financially. It was just us paying right out of pocket. There were many, many months that we paid literally out of our paycheck to just keep it going. And we'd work a job all week long, and then we would have, you know, two or three shows a week. And we were just fronting the bills of the actual, you know, facility itself, the rent, the water, the utilities, and whatnot.
Before we get more into the financials of it, let's backtrack a little bit and tell me more about transforming this space, like in the corner of a literal strip mall on Ringgold Road, right? Mm-hmm. Between like a hair salon and a game store? Is that right? What was the other side? Maybe not a game store for very long. It eventually changed, I think.
The game store was a couple down the row.
Okay.
The directly beside us almost always was like an insurance agent, I think.
And
then there was a hair salon, you know, on the other side of us. And then there was a tanning bed and a video game store. And, you know, it changed.
Right. So you're a small town strip mall. You're in the literal corner. Right.
Right.
So being in the corner, you probably had the most space also out of all the different stores in this strip mall. Tell me about transforming that space into what was an ideal venue of what you could use there with these low ceilings, right? And concrete floors. Tell me about what kind of restrictions or difficulties maybe you had with like noise complaints. Or the way the parking was situated with having – when you were going to have a good amount of people there, having a lot of them park in the back where mm-hmm. you weren't going to be able to keep an eye on a lot of people. So tell mm-hmm. me about kind of all that.
Yeah, it was difficult. You know, it definitely was not set up for what we wanted to do at all. So as soon as we moved in, we had to make some modifications. We tried to soundproof a couple of the walls and we did a little parking lot in the back. I remember my grandfather came out with a tractor and we put in kind of a small parking lot in the back. And
oh, you guys made that parking lot.
Right.
In the back.
Yeah. When we first moved in, there was probably six or seven spots back there and that was it.
Right.
And it was like a, you know, just kind of a grown up field.
Oh,
He was able to bring a tractor back there and we kind of plowed it out and put some gravel down and went that route. So we did a few things, you know, we put a small, we built a small bar in there. My stepdad at the time did. And then we put a wall up just to help, separate it into kind of make two rooms out of it. And then we had just a ton of thrift store type furniture and whatnot. And a lot of that had to do with...
What wall are you talking about, like for the sound booth?
Yeah, there was a wall like back behind the sound booth that a friend of ours did some art on. Yeah, for sure.
Take money.
Well, kind of when you first walked in, there was a wall there that
to your left.
A friend of ours, Cheryl, did some artwork on, and to the left, just to kind of separate it and make it feel like it was two rooms instead of just one giant room, you know. And then that also gave us a place to put the sound console and a bunch of the equipment and things like that.
Right on the other side. Yeah, I got you.
Right on the other side of that. Mm-hmm. So. Matt helped out a ton with all that, and he had a lot of that experience of just building and doing different handy things. And,
yeah, very handy. Yeah. Like, you pretty much built the whole stage himself, right?
Right, yeah. Yeah, me and him and my brother and maybe a few other folks helped out build that stage, but yeah.
That stage went through a lot of stomps.
Yes, it did.
A lot of holes got stomped in it.
A lot of beatings. So then that kind of gets us through... You know, the first initial, like, okay, we're finally in, we're settled by probably summer of 2008.
Well, talk to me a little bit about, just a little bit more on transforming that space. Like, you really attempted to make it your own and make it this place that, I don't know, seemed normal for the kind of thing that you were doing. You had these people in skinny jeans and crazy hair and black t-shirts with monsters on them all coming through all the time, right? These people that didn't feel accepted in other places that they went, but they felt accepted here. And a lot of that had to do with the aesthetic also, with how it looked. You had cymbals and drum heads signed by popular bands that these people liked, that they could see on the wall, that maybe it was the first time they'd been there, and they'd say, oh, wow, I can't believe this band has been here before, and it makes me want to come back to this place. Tell me about some of those ideas, like, or maybe the posters, having a big screen TV that you look like you got from a thrift store that we played wrestling DVDs on, right? To kind of cultivate fun, right? Just tell me a little bit about kind of that process.
Yeah. Just like you said, I mean, we didn't have any money really. And we wanted to, but we wanted to make it feel like a place to hang out. In between bands, we would play DVDs and whatnot on TVs and different things. And I mean, that was totally a Club Fathom thing from years prior. They would play, you know, videos and stuff. And I just always enjoyed that myself. It gives you something to watch and just anything with the space, you know, to make it feel. To make it feel comfortable and exciting and just kind of different.
We had like foosball and ping pong tables.
Yeah,
I think
we
at
had
one
a couple games at one
stuff
point.
Stuff like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Just something to give people something to do in between, because you always have that 20 or 30 minute, you know, exchange of the band swapping all their gear on stage and everything. So it just can be boring and whatnot. We wanted people to hang out all night and sit through every band, you know, hopefully, and you know, see something that they liked or figure out something new and find a new band and whatnot. So we try to create a space that people would enjoy and they would stay around but with extremely little to no budget. So a lot of it was very DIY, and which is funny, but we were semi-OCD about the space. I remember bands always saying, "This is the cleanest bathroom of any venue I've ever seen."
Yes.
I remember that.
Shelly only had one.
Yeah, we just had that one bathroom. But Shelly, Matt's wife, would keep that thing clean, and it was always nice and neat around. We swept and vacuumed almost every night, and we were just kind of oddly OCD about the space and keeping it nice and clean. And that just threw a lot of bands off. They enjoyed it and they liked it, but they were just like a little weirded out by, why is this place so, you know, so neat and clean, and, you know, it smelt good and all those different things, which was kind of funny. But we were trying to do it with excellence, and we were trying to do something, you know, and keep it nice, because we would have, you know, other rentals, and we would have birthday parties, and we would occasionally do other events there. I remember we had a couple.
I don't think you have to make excuses for keeping something clean.
Right. But yeah, most places that are going
to
host, you know, hard music, heavy music, you know, shows.
They didn't care a lot about that kind of stuff.
They didn't care, and it wasn't like that at all, you know, but we were trying to be a flex space, and we were trying
exactly.
to, you know, we were trying to bridge between like a DIY punk venue and a coffee shop. Like, where's the happy medium to where it's, we can do a little bit of both, and we can have a night with acoustic artists and be more of a coffee shop, for lack of better terms. But we also wanted to book the punk band and have some of those folks come out and enjoy as well. So we tried to find the medium there.
Do you think having it real clean and being presented professional, and using the space to rent out for, like you said, birthday parties or other promoters to book their brand of music or whatever, do you think that was part of the business plan all along for Matt, maybe when he came in?
I don't think so. I don't really remember exactly how some of that came. But, I mean, any opportunity that involved, you know, hey, we want to rent the space for X amount of dollars, for $100, $200, $300, whatever, we would almost always say yes, because we just needed it to make ends meet and just to get by. So, you know, some of the things we didn't plan for, I remember, most people won't know this, but we actually rented it out to Silverdale High School. We had probably 3 or 4, I guess what they would call banquets, not necessarily a dance, but a banquet for Silverdale High School. So that's kind of funny for those who are from this area and know that school. But yeah, so we would do anything like that would provide a little bit of income just to help keep things rolling and keep things moving.
Absolutely. So what, back to kind of sharing a strip mall with kind of a variety of different stores, but your space was really only open from 5 o'clock to 10 or 11 o'clock, mostly weekend nights, right? So what do you think some of the other tenants thought about you?
Yeah, I think that a few of them hated us. I think that there was a mutual, you know, just didn't understand, didn't get it, didn't, you know, they would see some of our people that were coming out to shows, you know, they looked, they're dressed a certain way, and it just, they just didn't understand. So they just, there was a couple that just disliked us. There was a few that didn't care, and that, but for the most part, most of them were already gone by the time we would come in and open up. So, you know, it wasn't like a huge, huge thing, but there definitely was like some friction there with a few of the other tenants and whatnot, and we had to deal with that, and that's just part of this, you know, this world and hosting. Unless you can just afford to have your own, you know, building on your own piece of property, which is extremely, extremely difficult to do, then you have to, you know, almost all music venues over the years, you have to deal with your neighbors and you have to figure it out, and it's always going to be a struggle. But that was just, that's just how we did it.
So things are going good. You've got the warehouse open. We're a good ways into 2008 at this point, it seems. You've already developed a good relationship with a lot of agencies and labels where you're getting offers to bring bands in. What kind of tour packages are you seeing coming through at this time, early warehouse days? Like, what were some of the better shows that you remember? What kind of numbers were they doing?
That first year, I think we were, you know, a good show would have been 75, maybe 80 people. 2008, you know, most everyone knows that that was when the recession hit the U.S. and the economy basically crashed. And which we always joke around like, hey, the economy crashed, let's start a business. You know, right. It was a horrible idea.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we didn't really realize it at the time. But in 2007 was really when the music industry started declining. Like, that's the year that they look back on now, and that's really when the decline of it started changing from album sales turning into digital downloads, most of which were illegal for the first few years there.
Right, until so, iTunes kind of capitalized on
it. Right, until they finally figured it all out. But late 2007, 2008 was like the initial major decline of buying an actual physical CD. And so
do you think that decline in people wanting to buy physical media also had to do with declining numbers in live music? Like, people could get something onto their computer at their house and listen to it there with ease rather than using a CD in their car or something. How do you think that correlated to live music?
I think maybe it had more to do, though, with the economy in general. You know, of course, just a lot of people who listen to this style of music, a lot of us don't have much money in the first place.
Right.
But, you know, it does trickle down as far as jobs and, like, you know, major businesses take a hit, and then it goes all the way. The domino effect eventually gets down to those of us who are kind of at the lower end of the chain, and, you know, there's less pay or less jobs available. So, you know, there might be a good show on a Thursday night, but either A, you had to work because you're, you know, you need to work to just make ends meet or whatever, or B, you didn't have the extra $12 or whatever to come spend on a show, even though you would have enjoyed it, you just couldn't do it because the economy at the time had really crashed out, and a lot of people felt that. You know,
how many times do you remember letting maybe some regulars, some of the kids, come in and see shows that just begged you, Casey, this is my favorite band this week that I've got to see, that I can't afford the $6 tonight. How many times do you remember letting people in to come and see that? Or
I think that
seeing
people waiting
until an inside baseball term when we pull the door and we take the money that was taken in over the night, usually midway through the last band, to count it, to prepare the money to pay the bands for the night, and then people trying to sneak in at that point.
I think that's extremely specific, what you just said. Yeah, no, I think that that happened a lot, and we tried to be a very loving people, and we tried to, you know, as much as we could, you know, allow some folks to get in and see the shows. And, you know, I always thought about, you know, I'd rather have them in the room and enjoying this and experiencing this band or this tour with us than to just sit outside and not pay anything or whatever. So there was times when I would let in people because of that. Like, okay, well, they're not going to pay either way, so I'd rather have them in the room to have more people in the room just to feel better, but also for them to experience this, what we're getting to experience, you know.
Or maybe even exchange it for work. I remember a lot of times we would let them sweep afterwards change the trash cans or something.
Yeah, we tried to create volunteer opportunities. And
yeah, absolutely.
That was something I wasn't great at, but we tried to do that along the way. And, you know, and we have friendships with people that, you know, were some of those people. So,
so we're in a bit of a decline overall in the economy. You're feeling the hit at the warehouse, even though you've just opened. But do you feel like numbers are already starting to decline? Initially this question was about the kind of offers and the kind of tours, the kind of bands you were having in this first year. Tell me about some of them and some of the numbers for those shows. I specifically remember one of the very early shows being a My Children, My Bride show, doing okay. A title fight show, I think.
Right.
Who else can you think of within that first year? Notable acts.
Right. I remember the band Vania came around a good bit that first year. The band, before there was Rosalyn, it was a lot of like lower card bands that were really good bands, but they were like lower on their specific label, or maybe they were independent at the time. But we didn't have a lot of B markets,
which is what we were.
We didn't have a lot of big names that first year. We really didn't.
Kind of another inside term, as in like an A market being a major city, like Nashville, sure, and Atlanta. Yeah,
right.
Like, so they'll skip Chattanooga because there's just a 2-hour drive.
Right.
But maybe a smaller band might hit what they call these B level markets, which would be more like cities like Knoxville and Chattanooga.
Right. Yeah, we weren't even considered, you know, at the time for, you know, for August Burns Red and Under Oath and Norma Jean and these kind of bands, you know, we weren't even on the radar, just because Chattanooga, like you said, was a B market. Now, as the years went on, you know, that a lot of artists, and as the decline in music started happening, you know, Chattanooga started opening up for those same artists to come through, because they had already played Atlanta, you know, 30 times by then, and they'd already played Nashville 40 times. So then all of a sudden, our city kind of became on the radar for them.
Right, and maybe those bands specifically played those bigger cities in support of another band, and maybe now they're headlining their own tour.
True.
But they can only fill a room in a beat market.
Right.
And that was kind of our major market for tours.
True, yes.
A lot of times.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. So in 08, you know, there wasn't, you know, no big names. I don't think. I think we might have done one or two larger shows, but really we were just trying to get the ball rolling and figure out how to run a business. You know, I was in my young 20s, but also how to, you know, keep the venue alive. I knew how to book shows, but now it's like, okay, how do I do it in such a way that financially we can keep this building, you know, keep this building open, and how do we do that? But also, being a band guy, you know, and I was in bands the whole time, was how do I also compensate these bands for their time and their art, and not just, you know, I didn't want to be that venue who, you know, pocketed the band's fair share of, you know, yes, we're providing the space, we're opening the doors, but at the same time, these bands are providing the art. So how do you compensate them in a fair way, in the right way, but also keep our doors open? So it's a lot of give and take. It's a large catch 22, if you will, on how do you keep both afloat, and how do you keep the and also not, you know, I guess not, you know, lack of any kind of integrity or honesty and things like that, because we had seen that at multiple venues, and we were like, okay, we can't do that. We have to be honest. We have to keep our integrity up, just because that's who we are. But at the same time,
why you wanted to start it? You wanted to create this community, this all ages thing where people could come and have this safe space for teens and young adults. So obviously you wanted to have integrity, like you were just saying.
Right.
And especially, and on the business end.
Yeah.
So did you feel that pinch, like, after a while with being this band dude that wanted to make sure all the bands were taken care of, but were having trouble paying the rent and the electricity? And how did that affect your relationship with your first partner in Matt?
Yeah, it definitely did. You know, I always had the looked at it from a band perspective for the most part, and I would, you know, try to give the bands what I felt like was fair, what was due to them, because I knew how hard it was and the struggle of that side of things. But at the same time, you know, I knew the stress and the weight of also keeping the doors open. So so that Matt had to keep me in line as far as that goes, and tried to, you know, always, you know, look after, well, if the doors are closed, then there won't be any bands. You know, there's always that argument. And so, you know, we would go back and forth a little bit with that. But all in all, we stayed good friends through it, and never had a big fallout or anything like that. So thankfully, we would always figure it out at the end of the day, and we would just keep on moving. So,
well, eventually Matt did end up leaving and leaving his partnership with you with the warehouse. What kind of led to that happening? Was there anything legally that had to happen because of the warehouse being an official business, like an LLC? Tell me about that process.
No, nothing official. He basically, a few years in, you know, he just felt like it was time for him to just move on and focus on other things of life.
Right. I mean, he's putting a lot of time into this place, just like you are. You think he got a little burnout? Maybe he was ready to focus more on his personal life, start a family, that kind of stuff?
Yeah, I think so. If I remember correctly, I think that him and his wife were pregnant with their first son around that time, or maybe...
or right before, or close to it.
Yeah, very close to it, I think, if I recall. And so yeah, I think just timing-wise, it was kind of a no hard feelings, just need to move on and kind of let this stress side of my life go. And this season for them was kind of up, and you know, there was no hard feelings there, and we just kept moving and stayed good friends through it. And you know, that was the great thing about that was you know, we had both invested a lot of time and a lot of our personal money as well. But
so there was never any issue with that? Like, Matt never felt like he was owed money or anything like that? That was never any drama or issue with that?
Not really, no. And now he might correct me and might say something different. I can't remember 100%. But I do know that at the end of the day, you know, there was never, you know, we were never upset at each other. And it was just, you know, kind of a clean, like, hey, I'm going to just let you take it and you keep running with it and do your thing.
You're just going to move on.
Yeah. I think there was some money owed, and I think we ended up slowly making payments to pay him back some money, maybe,
okay,
from what I remember. And but it was just like a slow payment process deal that we worked out together or something like that. So so at the end of the day, it wasn't a, you know, wasn't a huge drama deal or nothing like that. It was just they were ready to move on, and I just kind of took it from there.
So with Matt out now, the warehouse, a lot of people may or may not know, has always been kind of a two-man job. You've really been the face of it, and then there's usually someone backing you, helping you with a lot of everything, right? So with Matt coming out, who stepped up to kind of fill that void? What was the volunteer staff like at the time? Had it kind of evolved since that first livestock? Where were these people coming from? Tell me kind of about that process.
I think over time that just new people had started new bands and different people were hanging out there, so new friendships were kind of sparking and starting through a lot of that. So some of the initial people who were around at the first, you know, let's say 2008, half of 2009,
right.
Some of those folks had kind of, you know, started other projects or started doing other things, gotten new jobs, maybe moved out of Chattanooga, you know, different, had moved on to different seasons in their life. And so, and then in this, at the same time, there's other people coming in that were in a new season for their life, and they were in a new band, or they were just, you know, interested in music, in the music culture and the music scene. And so they were just hanging around. They would come to shows, and out of that, I met a few guys, and that's kind of when I first met a guy named Sean Hines, and also a guy named Matt Skalerik, and a few other guys that were, that was kind of with them and their friend group. And some of those guys started helping out. And so, so as soon as Matt had kind of stepped out of that role, my friend Sean kind of stepped in to helping with booking and helping with audio and lighting and just the space, opening, closing, and just kind of more or less managing the space and also helping with promoting and booking as well. So
right, there was a lot that went into just for this kind of two-man job, kind of making sure everything got done, sounded good, bands got paid, all the professional aspects of it, but while also managing this staff of basically your friends, your friend group of volunteers, of people that would show up at any given show ready to sweep the floors, take people's money as they come in, help monitor the parking lots, help people find parking, clean toilets, change trash cans, sell Cokes and chips at the bar, help during set changes, help monitor mosh pits, right? These are all kind of the duties of the volunteer staff. But when it came down to it, it was all just kind of our friend group, the people we were friends with, like you were saying, the people that were interested in coming to these shows. They were also really centered around a lot of the people that we went to church with. We all kind of went to church together also.
Right.
We all eventually... a good portion of us lived in a house together just right down the road from the East Ridge venue for a long time, which made it easy to go back and forth between shows. We kind of always knew who was going to be there to help out, to do what.
Right.
So talk about Sean coming in with his new kind of – this new group of a few people forming bands, helping out, helping like what you were saying with the booking. I feel like Sean was a huge help when it came to audio. At the time, tell me a little bit about Sean's impact at the time.
Right. I think exactly what you said. And I think that he helped out with multiple different areas, and he was in a band as well. Shout out Dead End Stanley. And he started out as a solo artist, I think, and then under that name, and then he merged into a band. But him and my friend Andrew and Matt, they all kind of helped out together. Sean more so. He just put in more hours probably. And yeah, helped out a lot with audio. And
do you think he was just like-minded, kind of had the same vision as you? It just sort of happened naturally? Or was it something you approached Sean about?
I think so. No, it was very natural. And he just jumped in and was willing to help and just a great guy. So I think he just... it did happen very natural. It wasn't something that I had to seek out or go look for. And, you know, I think that, you know, in a sense, God provided people at the right time. And for sure, when him and a couple of his friends came into the picture, that was kind of like a definitely a needed thing. And I felt like it just worked out great and very like-minded as me.
Do you remember Sean bringing any kind of influence to the booking at the time, maybe like the kind of local bands now that were being played, anything like that? Maybe people Sean knew that you didn't, that brought in new local favorites?
Maybe. I don't remember exactly, but that's definitely a possibility. And he definitely had a little bit different of a music taste for sure. So when we would be booking, you know, there would be, you know, different opinions and whatnot. We'll be right back.
Sean is a great guy. Great. A big heart. Sean has a big heart for helping people on a global scale. There was something that was very popular at the time, especially within alternative music scenes, a group called The Invisible Children. And Sean, I guess, what's the word I'm looking for? Sean got very inspired by that and then wanted to get very involved and then ended up going out on tour to educate people about that crisis, about what was going on with child slavery, child armies in Uganda. Is that right?
Right.
And so that put a little bit of damper on how much Sean could help with the warehouse, especially with him not being central to Chattanooga anymore. He was literally touring across the United States, then even became moved up in staff positions within Invisible Children and then eventually on to a program called Link, which was Liberty in North Korea, to educate people about the human rights crisis in North Korea also. And so Sean, it's almost seemed like his priorities changed. Not that it was a bad thing at all. It was a great thing. So he kind of moved on. So now you kind of have this void again, with not having someone just kind of right there and beside you helping out. Obviously, you had still a big close friend group with volunteer staff to help these shows happen week after week. But then eventually I came in and kind of filled that void. Tell us a little bit about, I don't know, our initial meeting mm-hmm. and kind of how I phased in to fill in that role.
Yeah, I remember a show in East Ridge, and you and I think Joey, maybe a guy named Donnie, all came, I think, on the same night, maybe. And I kind of met a few of you all at one time and had kind of knew who you guys were from shows over the years, but not really officially ever like friends or like, you know, officially ever hung out. So
right. You might have seen us just kind of right. grouped together at
seen
a Fathom
you around.
Show.
Exactly. Yeah. But never
Joey
really.
Joey was a hard guy to miss.
Right. Yeah. Of course.
Big personality.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, we just started talking that first night there, talked a lot about music. I think actually while you were at school still in Colorado, we had exchanged some messages back and forth about
yep on MySpace.
Yep, you had said that you were coming back to town and you wanted to help out. Maybe you had
actually,
said something like
I
that.
I think it was originally I was in a metalcore band with some of my close friends based out of Trenton, Georgia, called Buried in December.
Yeah.
And I was coming back from school to move to Chattanooga permanently because I was in Georgia. Or no, I was in Colorado at the time.
Right.
And we were going to play a house show, and I reached out to you to get within to play this house show. And so we just got to talking. I don't know. I think we had – I think on MySpace you could put like – I don't know, people that had similar interests as us, we would take like album covers or something. And there was like this sidebar on the left where you could talk about like interests or something. Do you remember that? And you could put, a lot of people would put like album covers that they really liked. And we instantly linked on Beloved and Living Sacrifice. And there probably wasn't a lot of people in either of our lives at the time that liked those specific bands so intensely as we did.
Right.
And I think that we kind of...
we clicked with those bands for sure. Yeah,
for sure, initially.
Right.
And then just really getting to meet officially in person at that house show was fun. Tell me what you remember about that house show.
I remember someone kicked a hole in the wall, I think.
Yes.
And someone else got really mad about it. I do remember that. But then I think I remember hearing that the guy who put on the show and his mom didn't really care and it wasn't that big of a deal or
right, yeah.
something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and I remember I think that was the first time I'd ever met Todd Preston as well. He played
really?
That show. Right. I think
how
that
funny.
Was the first time I'd met him, I believe. I could be wrong. But yeah, I believe we played there in the living room, and you know, there's a couple folks that moshed around and had a good time. So
yeah, do you feel like this random house show in Trenton, Georgia, that people knew within at this time when it was kind of within on a decline?
I think so. I think we played, you know, fourth or fifth or whatever in the lineup, and I think, you know, we brought a few folks with us or whatever from Chattanooga, and you know, had some people, you know, moshing for us or whatever at the time,
right?
But however that thing worked, and so I mean, I don't know. I felt like some of the people there knew who we were, and you know, Trenton's close enough to where we were basically a local band to there anyway. So
right,
yeah. No, I remember that being a great show, and
it was fun.
Yeah, it was just rowdy, and it was fun.
Yeah, exactly.
Anytime you play in a house with more than 20, 25 people, you know, it's just a lot of fun and rowdy.
There's probably a good, what are you, like 60 people in and out over that whole night?
Yeah,
and somebody's in someone's living room. It's pretty crazy.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, it was fun. Yeah. So, yeah, that was kind of our initial meeting, get together. And then from there, I think some of my friends had started to either already help out or maybe were coming and hanging out with you guys when you would play ping pong, or maybe there was a Bible study already. I'm not sure. I know that my friends Zach and Joey and Donnie were all kind of around at that time, because Zach was the lead vocalist of a band that had played a few times already. And so it already kind of developed relationships with a lot of the staff there. And so I was finally rooted back in Chattanooga after moving from where I was in school in Colorado. And so I just came and hung out one night with all of you guys when you were there. And I think that's where we kind of clicked some more. I know I clicked a lot with Sean that night too. So yeah, I think I just, there was never really anything that we just sat down and talked about. We're very similar when it comes to being natural leaders. And so I just naturally started helping with things that required leadership. I would see a need for maybe some volunteers to start doing something. So I'd be like, hey, let's go and do this, right? I would just initiate something happening. And I think you just saw me taking the lead a lot of times. And then we probably just talked all the time about the business aspect of the warehouse, which I was always interested in. And so I think you eventually just gave me opportunities to help book also. Like eventually a lot of the times I was more in charge of booking the local bands for shows. And so I kind of developed a lot of relationships with them and sort of really headed that. What do you remember about kind of that time, about Sean phasing out, me phasing in? What do you remember about the shows at the time? Do you remember numbers going up? Because really the last time we've talked anything about numbers, things were kind of sort of steady, but if anything, we're kind of down because of the economy being so bad. Mm-hmm. But at this time would have been early 2009 now.
Right.
And I feel like things started to look up. So tell me what you remember about kind of all that and me getting involved.
Right. Across America, I think looking back at it, we would hear stories that from most of the bands that a lot of the venues were closing or they were doing really bad around that 2009, 2010 timeframe. So we were in East Ridge there all of 08, 09, and 2010. And in 09 and 2010, we had kind of gotten in a groove of, you know, of we knew what we were doing and we were established and we had kind of figured things out to an extent.
Yeah, so I feel like we became a pretty good team pretty fast.
Sure.
And, yeah, like you said, we really kind of got our feet under ourselves and really started to figure things out and got a better reputation within Chattanooga as a community, but also on a national level through agencies and booking agents, band managers that wanted to reach out and have their bands play in our city, right?
Right. Yeah, so shows, you know, started getting better and better, like the offers that we were getting. We would get names that we were like, dang, you know, we started, you know, growing as far as like what you said, you know, just in the booking agent's eyes of, you know, a legitimate space, you know, right outside of Chattanooga. Of course, our address was always East Ridge, and that made it hard.
Yes, because it was a big detriment for a long time.
Right, no one had heard of East Ridge, so we would a lot of times put Chattanooga on flyers, but then we'd have to email the bands and just say, hey, just so you know, and once you type this in your, you know, at the time everybody's using these like Garmin GPSs in their cars before the iPhone or whatever. So we just say, make sure you put East Ridge, you know, in your actual GPS instead of Chattanooga. But we were like 5 minutes outside of Chattanooga. So it was like, hey, that just makes so much more sense. And that's really the city that we're claiming and whatever, you know. So, but shows got better and things were moving along, and you know, financially it was never good, really, to be honest. But it got more and more feasible, and as years went by there, or as months went by, you know, we were figuring it out. We were figuring out where to cut from, what to cut back, and then what to do more of. You know, what shows, you know, produce a little bit more income.
Profit. Right.
Yep. What local bands would actually work hard.
Exactly.
What touring acts would actually bring the people that the booking agents said that they would. You know, it took a while, but we finally figured a lot of those little things out. And that turned around into more income, but that still wasn't paying the bills per se, but at least it was helping, and we were just making the right moves from a business perspective. We were making better moves, and
absolutely better than we had at any point
right
since then.
Right.
And so what that was doing, and it was just a lot of times it was the little things that would, especially when it came to agencies and managers, bands would come back to them and tell them what a good time they had at our venue, because we cultivated this environment that was fun for bands, but was also professional. Like, we had great changeover. Like, we had made sure we had people ready to get those drums and gear off stage to get other people on fast and efficiently. Right. We tried to make sure that people were safe, like out there in the pit, as they say, like having a good time. So bands wanted to play our venue, and because we, like you were talking about earlier, you like to be around people, and I'm the same way. People would call us social butterflies. Mm-hmm. We wanted to be with these bands and hang out with them and be their friends, and that's just kind of what happened. Mm-hmm. We made friendships with a lot of bands that would come through a lot of times, and they would go back and tell their labels, their agencies, like they want to make sure on their next tour that they come back to the warehouse. And that was important, because those little things, even though they were just us establishing relationships with people, which was kind of the main goal, it was helping us be profitable also, because now we were getting bigger and bigger offers. Like what we were talking about earlier when we had Chariot headliners, Norma Jean headliners. What are some other notable headliners come through in East Ridge in our time there that you can think of?
East Ridge. We had the Almost in East Ridge. We had Disciple played East Ridge. We had Advent in East Ridge a couple times.
Yeah. Oh Sleeper. Word Alive.
Yeah. We actually had Animals as Leaders played East Ridge.
Oh, let's talk about that show. Not a lot of people know this story.
Yeah,
the nightmare that it was.
Right. There was like, you know, a snowstorm in Chattanooga, which equals about 4 inches of snow. But when that happens in Chattanooga area, you know, the whole city shuts down and whatever. So actually, we had gotten, you know, texts and, you know, calls from friends that were trying to come to that show, but they shut down like half of Ringgold Road, which is where the venue was.
So you just couldn't get there.
You literally couldn't get to the venue. So some of the bands were from, you know, the Midwest or the North Midwest or the North Northeast, you know,
they
were laughing and
yeah.
it was just, they thought it was hysterical that our whole city was shutting down over 4 inches or whatever. It was 3 to 4 inches if I remember right. But, so anyways, Animals as Leaders was on that show.
It was like Veil of Maya, Circle of Contempt, a lot of progressive metal.
Periphery.
Bands.
Yeah. It was in Periphery.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And also another big band now.
Literally stacked, like,
yeah,
that show would be insane nowadays, but
a local
but
band at per
the
millisecond.
Time, yeah. Right, yeah. Mm-hmm. So at the time, you know, it weren't as big of a deal at you know, just yet. Animals as Leaders was just getting well known at the time. So, and so was Periphery, and now they could both headline tours and, you know, kill it. So that show did about what 35 people or something,
maybe,
and right. it was a huge issue, right? It was
because
a bummer,
of the guarantee.
Yeah. Right. Yes. So we ended up, they were nice enough to where they understood.
Inside baseball, a guarantee is the money that we agree upon to pay flat, no matter how many people come to the show, not based off any sort of percentage, a flat rate to pay the bands for them playing that night.
Right.
Okay, go ahead.
So the guarantee for that show, I don't know, maybe 1,500, maybe something like that.
I don't super remember. I just remember it was a huge issue because of no one showing up.
Yeah, so it was, let's say, $1,500, and the door only brought in like 300 or 400. So the tour package was nice enough to where they understood, you know.
They were pretty cool, yeah.
Yeah, they were cool about it.
They understood the situation.
They just said, well, give us 100% of the door, and we said, okay, cool.
We were happy to do that.
And we gave them everything that came in that night, and that was kind of is what it was. They played in front of 30 people, and they played the set. But
it was a learning process for us because though the bands were cool, like we were talking about trying to form relationships with agents and stuff, the lady that we had to talk to that night was not cool about it.
Right. We had never dealt with, like, a natural disaster or, like, a storm or, you know— And years prior to that, I had dealt with a tornado watch for that Haste the Day show that we had booked
at Fathom
years prior. There was actually a tornado watch or warning out that night, and the numbers were really low, and I didn't make the guarantee and lost a lot of money and et cetera, et cetera. But I didn't really learn my lesson at the time. So then years later, you know, on our end of things, we should have had that kind of built into the agreement, you know, ahead of time, but we didn't. And so thankfully that night they were cool enough to say, hey, I get it. You know, there's occasionally a natural, you know, something that happens like that, that keeps a lot of people from coming to the show. And then there's like a, you know, a loophole of sorts to protect us to where we're not going to have to pay them because obviously that was out of our control. But also on the band's side of view that there's something to protect them because they drove all that way. So it's just this, you know, this fine line of trying to, you know, be fair to both parties. So,
but it was a big learning experience for us as a business.
Right.
As we ended up implementing the thing called an inclement weather clause to keep us from being in a situation like that again. So kind of like what we were talking about before, we're just learning with every new show. We're learning how to be more professional, how to be a real venue, right?
True.
But at the same time, cultivate this community for young adults and teens to come and have this safe place to hang out and form friendships, to get loved on when sometimes they don't have that anywhere else, like at home. They'd rather be anywhere else but home than we gave them a place to be.
Right.
And so we did that at the same time while trying to slowly learn and grow to be profitable. And that's when we got more opportunities to bring in these bands, like we were talking about, more of which, let's see, who are some other notables we had, Plea for Purging a few times, in their heyday, impending doom.
Yeah.
Yeah, we dipped our toes into what was very popular at the time with the deathcore scene, a band like Suffocate, a very noteworthy show that went really well was a Ghost Inside headliner tour. I remember that band in particular, they're a California-based band, and being very impressed with our venue and with Tennessee in general. Like, I guess our crowd being so hyped, like, to see them play. It was a very cool environment. And it was also... That shows another good example of kind of how we did business. So that tour package, I think, was the Ghost Inside for the Fallen Dreams after they had just gotten a new singer, new vocalist, which was an issue sometimes with that guy. What was on that package? Suffocate was on that package. One other band, I think. But why I bring this up is because we did our best to, when we formed friendships with bands, we tried to do favors all the time and get bands on shows that they were going to be in town for a Warren to play. A notable band signed to Victory Records before there was Rosalind got to play that show just because they happened to be in town at that time. And so we put them on that show just because we had formed friendships with that band. They're great guys.
Right.
We had a lot in common. They really respected what we were doing and appreciated it. And we just clicked on so many levels. And so those are the kind of people we always tried to help out. Mm-hmm. And then a band now that's very noteworthy, Gideon, at the time, who was really more of just a Alabama local, but also / a warehouse local, because they'd played so often.
Right.
And were so hugely influenced by a band like the Ghost Inside, who was really at the top of their game at the time in melodic hardcore. And so I don't remember if they asked us to get on or if we offered it to them, but I could see it happening either way, because we always tried to reach out to these bands that knew would want to play with these other nationally recognized bands and kind of make memories, right? And cultivate community like we keep talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So even at that point, we were trying to do things like that, and then we didn't know it at the time, but things like that end up helping us in the long run, right? Because now a band like before there was Rosalind would get even a little bit bigger, and now they want to come back to the warehouse. So if they're the opening band on a tour, but maybe have an in with the agent that's booking it, now that tour is going to come to the warehouse when maybe it didn't beforehand. And so that's just a little example of, even though that was a great show for us, I remember it going well, being profitable, I think, having a great time. But also really helped us in the long run, right? Like little things. Let's see. There were so many bands that played in Eastridge. We were there for a long time. What? Let's see, 2008 to 2010?
Yeah, we left Eastridge in, I want to say it was January 2011. Yes! Don't be dead to say! Hey, once again, thanks for listening to the podcast, and we're going to be putting out probably two more episodes about the rest of the warehouse history, but we also have recorded some content about really the beginnings of the heavy music scene in Chattanooga area, and we'd love to hear from you if you know kind of where it started. And back in the late 90s, we're trying to gather more information and more of the history of Chattanooga and the local hardcore metal scene and punk scene from the late 90s and early 2000s. So if you wouldn't mind, give us a shout, contact us, and let us know. We'd love to hear from you. And thanks again for listening. We'll catch you next time on Chattahoochee.